China-U.S. relationship has come to a new critical juncture.
China has a new representative in Washington. This is Friday, July 30th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, a China-Taliban meeting draws a positive reaction from the United States. Recent rains have been too much for even Chinese sponge cities to handle. We'll check in with the Tokyo Olympics. New COVID-19 infections are spiking throughout Japan. The UN calls for an end to COVID-19 school closures. It is all on today's VOA Asia. China's new ambassador to Washington, Chen Gang, wished the United States victory against COVID-19 and said great potential awaited bilateral relations, striking an optimistic tone as he arrived at his new post amid deeply strained ties. Reuters' Brian Wood has the story.
China's new ambassador to the U.S., Chen Gang, on Wednesday expressed optimism about his country's relations with Washington. He hoped for America's swift recovery from COVID-19 and said the two countries have great potential for working together.
I firmly believe that the door of China-U.S. relations, which is already open, cannot and should not be closed. This is the trend of the world, the call of the times, and the will of the people.
Chen is replacing Cui Tengkai, China's longest-serving ambassador to the U.S. He stepped down last month after 8 years. Chen did two stints as a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman between 2006 and 2014. He earned a reputation for pointed public defenses of his country's positions. Chen's remarks come days after talks between Chinese and American diplomats ended in tension. Washington and Beijing signaled concessions had to be made on both sides in order to move forward with any talks. U.S.-China relations had faltered drastically under former President Donald Trump. The post of the U.S. ambassador to China hasn't been filled since last year, when Republican Terry Branstad stepped down to help with Trump's re-election campaign. Biden has yet to nominate a replacement, though foreign policy circles consider Nicholas Burns, a former ambassador to NATO, a favorite.
Brian Wood reporting. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. Malaysian premier faces calls to resign after palace rebuke. Phuket restricts travel from other Thai regions as COVID-19 cases surge. Vietnam accelerates vaccinations in COVID-19 epicenter. Pakistan to ban public sector, education, malls, air travel for the unvaccinated. A Hong Kong DJ goes on trial for sedition in the first use of the colonial era laws since the city's handover to China. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. China told a visiting Taliban delegation Wednesday it expected the insurgent group to play an important role in ending Afghanistan's war and rebuilding the country that, according to the Chinese Foreign Ministry, 9 Taliban representatives met Foreign Minister Wang Yi on a 2-day visit, during which a Taliban spokesman said the peace process and security issues were discussed. Wang said the Taliban is expected to play an important role in the process of peaceful reconciliation and reconstruction in Afghanistan. That according to an account of the meeting from the foreign ministry. He also said that he hoped the Taliban would crack down on the East Turkestan Islamic movement as it was a direct threat to China's national security, referring to a group China says is active in the Xinjiang region in China's far west. After that meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called the China-Taliban meeting possibly a positive thing. Blinken made his comment on a visit to India. VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad spoke with VOA on possible reasons the Chinese decided to meet with the Taliban.
We saw the Taliban leaders were given a very warm welcome in Beijing, And Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi himself received the Taliban delegation. And for the first time, we saw the Chinese released video footages of those meetings, those handshake with Taliban leaders, and also images of that meeting. So it seems that, you know, China is really trying to grab the vacuum that is being created because of the withdrawal of the United States and NATO allies from Afghanistan, and China is trying to step in. There must be some kind of a mediator which is able to convince both the parties that it is time to end this long war, because it has really prevented the entire region from economically progressing. And China has this ambition of extending its Belt and Road Initiative, this infrastructure project of President Xi, to Central Asia through Afghanistan.
BOA's Ayaz Gul in Islamabad. Earlier this week, Pakistan's prime minister said that America's accelerated troop exit from Afghanistan has left Washington with no bargaining power for arranging a peace deal between warring Afghans. This comes as the head of the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan said that the Taliban will lose the international legitimacy they gain through their negotiations in Doha if the group does not fulfill its obligation to negotiate with the Afghan government for a political settlement to the conflict. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, days of heavy rainfall have pounded Rohingya refugee camps in southern Bangladesh, destroying dwellings and sending thousands of people to live with extended families or in communal shelters. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are very happy you are with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Nearly a year's worth of rain fell on the Chinese city of Zhengzhou over 4 days this month. The flooding killed 71 people, including 14 trapped in a subway station as waters rose. Zhengzhou is part of a Chinese government initiative to build sponge cities in response to increasing urban flooding across the country. These cities aim to use natural processes to soak up rainwater rather than sending it coursing through concrete drainage pipes and channels that can get overwhelmed or cause other problems. These systems are catching on around the world as city planners embrace the benefits they provide, such as stormwater management, urban cooling, and aesthetic appeal. But experts say the storm that drowned Zhengzhou was more than any city's drainage system could handle. And because of climate change, these kinds of storms are becoming increasingly common around the world. In India, torrential monsoon rains in the west of the country have triggered floods and killed about 200 people. Experts link the increasingly erratic monsoon to climate change and warn that this poses a threat to the lives and livelihoods of millions of people. From New Delhi, Anjana Prasricha has this report.
After torrential monsoon rains buried villages under landslides and flooded towns in India's western Maharashtra state, the region is coping with the aftermath, homes reduced to rubble and inundated farmlands. Rescue teams have waded through debris and swirling waters to evacuate stranded people. It was too late for about 200 people who died.
It was raining very heavily. Then the landslide occurred and many people were washed away as they decided to run.
Much of the destruction occurred in districts along the west coast, a region that witnessed similar havoc 2 years ago. Climate experts link the rising incidence of such ferocious rainfall to global warming, which has affected the oceans where the monsoon winds originate.
The warming of the Arabian Sea and the Western Indian Ocean is bringing up a lot of heat into the atmosphere and also moisture, which is resulting in large-scale fluctuations in the monsoon winds. So though the monsoon winds are weak, occasionally there are episodes when they are very strong and releasing all of the moisture in a short time.
More than a quarter million people were evacuated. India's agriculture, which sustains more than half the country, is heavily dependent on the monsoon season. But the increasingly erratic rains destroy not just their homes, but also their farm-based livelihoods. Topsoil is washed away, groundwater is not recharged.
Any water-related infrastructure and economic activities that we have, from agriculture to dams to hydroelectricity to groundwater recharge, water supply, everything is getting affected because instead of rain falling over a period of 2 to 3 months, it is falling for a few days and in extreme conditions.
The rising incidence of extreme rains have made India particularly vulnerable to climate change, Bhushan says.
Some of the floods that have hit this country over the last 10 years have caused losses which are more than $1 billion. So this is affecting our economy. This is affecting livelihood. This is affecting jobs and growth.
Minimizing the impact on struggling communities worst hit by such disasters should be prioritized, say experts. The recent flooding came 2 months after a cyclone lashed the West Coast.
The maximum we are doing now is evacuating people. But that only saves lives, not livelihoods. We need to have resilient and sustainable infrastructure development based on these maps which shows the risk of these extreme events that are increasing.
Until that happens, experts warn millions may face the onslaught of such destruction. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un paid tribute to China's war dead at a Pyongyang memorial and vowed to maintain firm ties with Beijing as he seeks to bolster relations with his country's main ally amid deepening hardships linked to the pandemic. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia, Twitter, and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. The Olympics are facing several difficulties, but the games go on. Steve Ross reports for VOA Asia from Tokyo.
Both Japanese citizens and Olympic athletes must grapple with Japan's surging COVID-19 case count. Domestic media reporting newly registered cases throughout Japan exceeding 10,000 for the first time, with a daily record high of almost 3,900 new cases in Tokyo. And for some athletes, the competition schedule is not to their liking. With a 13-hour difference between Tokyo and America's East Coast, morning competition means lucrative evening broadcasts for networks and Olympic sponsors, but some athletes say they'd prefer events later in the day. With about 4,600 media members from 2,000 outlets visiting Japan, journalists face frequent COVID-19 testing and long delays getting in and out of events. International reporters and photographers must even submit activity plans for their first 2 weeks in Japan, subject to approval by Japanese authorities. Japan's youngest gold medalist ever at age 13, skateboarder Momiji Nishiya, is charming Japan now, but she says that she still has homework on her mind. Suniza Lee taking the Olympic gold in the women's gymnastics individual all-around final, with sidelined teammate Simone Biles cheering her on. Lee is 18 years old and the first Hmong member of Team USA. Japan running its gold medal tally for judo up to 8 today. Competing for Japan, Aaron Wolf, whose father is American, and Shiori Hamada, both taking the top podium tier at Tokyo's famed Budokan Arena. Team China surprising both the U.S. and Australia, taking the gold with a world record performance in the women's 4x200-meter freestyle relay. America coming in second with swimmer Allison Schmidt adding a silver medal to her collection, bringing her career Olympic medal total to 10. American pole vaulter Sam Kendricks testing positive for COVID-19. He is now out of the games. Tomorrow, track, boxing, beach volleyball, and much more. Steve Ross for VOA News, Tokyo.
Making headlines in Asia, a prominent Chinese pig farmer who was detained after praising lawyers during a crackdown on legal activists by President Xi's government was sentenced Thursday to 18 years in prison on charges of organizing an attack on officials and other offenses. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. As you just heard from Steve Ross, Tokyo officials reported a record high number of coronavirus cases Thursday for the third straight day. Japan's health ministry reported nearly 700 more than were reported on Wednesday. Tokyo's governor warned the cases could climb to 4,500 a day. The chief cabinet secretary of Japan said at a media briefing, new infections are also spiking throughout Japan on a scale the country has never experienced. Fiji's coronavirus crisis is worsening as reports of infections continue to soar in the South Pacific nation. The latest wave is occurring even though other parts of the Pacific have been spared the most severe impacts of the disease. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Although a small number of infections were detected early in the pandemic, Fiji went a year without recording any community transmission of COVID-19 until April 2021. But that's changing now, as cases of the highly transmissible Delta variant have been rising sharply, after a Fijian soldier working at a quarantine facility reportedly contracted the Delta variant of the virus from a traveller who'd returned from India. On Tuesday, 715 new COVID-19 infections and 11 deaths were recorded in Fiji, following a new daily record of 1,285 cases on Monday, according to Fiji's Ministry of Health and Medical Services. Charities have said the fragile health system is unable to cope with more than 18,000 active COVID-19 infections. Fiji's two largest hospitals in Suva and Lautoka have been converted into dedicated coronavirus facilities, with field hospitals set up to treat patients not infected with the virus. The Fijian government is resisting calls for a national lockdown, preferring instead to focus on vaccinations to keep the economy open. Only 18% of the population of about 900,000 people are fully inoculated, according to the health ministry. Australia has donated tens of thousands of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says her government has offered assistance as well.
Ultimately, as with any nation, it's up to the political leaders to decide how they wish to respond to a COVID outbreak. Same for New Zealand, same for any country. Of course, you know, we are here and ready and willing to offer any support or advice that we may have had from our experience.
Fiji is a South Pacific nation east of Australia, with an economy heavily dependent on tourism. Elsewhere in the Pacific region, Papua New Guinea has recorded 17,655 COVID-19 cases and 192 deaths, according to the World Health Organization. New Zealand has reported about 2,500 infections and 26 fatalities. The region's isolation has helped to protect island nations from the worst of the pandemic. Samoa and Vanuatu have recorded 1 and 3 coronavirus cases respectively, while no infections have been detected in Tonga and the Cook Islands. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As of early Thursday, COVID-19 had claimed the lives of nearly 4.2 million people worldwide and infected more than 196 million others, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. As we continue on VOA Asia, the UN Children's Fund is calling for an end to COVID-19 school closures, which it says are harmful for children's well-being and future prospects. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Schools in the Northern Hemisphere are closed for summer holidays. Elsewhere in the world, schools remain closed because of the pandemic, depriving more than 600 million children of an education. The UN Children's Fund reports nearly half the countries in Asia and Pacific have been closed for more than 200 days during the pandemic. Lengthy school closures also exist in Latin America and the Caribbean, and recent estimates show 40% of all school-aged children across eastern and southern Africa currently are not in school. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says these school closures are adversely affecting children's physical and mental well-being.
What this looks like, and we've learned this over the past year from the data, is that education and safety and friends and food are being replaced by anxiety and violence and teenage pregnancy. Across the globe, in all continents, we're seeing child helplines, a good precursor to understanding kids who are reporting violence, seeing often triple-digit increases.
Elder says remote learning is simply not an option for at least a third of the world's school children. He notes more than 80 million children across East Asia and the Pacific do not have access to distance learning during school closures. In Eastern and Southern Africa, he says schools in Uganda were closed for 306 days because of the pandemic, topping a list of 20 countries with the highest number of days of school closures. South Sudan comes in a close second. He adds most people in these countries have no access to the internet, thus excluding the possibility for remote learning.
If that doesn't resonate to those in power, then the World Bank does have a report showing around, their estimate is about a $10 trillion loss in earnings for this current cohort of students over time. UNICEF firmly believes this cannot go on. There is clear evidence, as you all know, that primary and secondary schools are not among the main drivers of this transmission.
UNICEF is urging all governments to reopen schools as soon as possible and not wait for the teachers and students to be vaccinated. It says the losses experienced by children are too great for them to wait any longer to receive the education and learn the skills that can help them build a better future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. said Thursday that its economy, the world's largest, advanced 6.5% in the April to June period, a slightly faster annualized pace than in the first 3 months of the year as the country steadily regains its footing from the economic devastation of the coronavirus. The size of the U.S. economy, nearly $23 trillion, now exceeds its pre-pandemic level as it recovers faster than many economists had predicted during the worst of the business closings more than a year ago. The surging Delta variant of the coronavirus is now threatening to impair business activity in some regions of the U.S., and as a result, analysts say the economy could cool somewhat in the coming months. But the second quarter growth was fueled with widespread business reopenings, vaccinations for millions of people, and trillions of dollars in government pandemic aid that was sent to all but the wealthiest American families. Republicans are mocking the CDC's updated mask guidance, calling for even vaccinated Americans to wear masks indoors in areas with high rates of virus spread. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Which is it? Vaccines or masks?
Texas's Chip Roy is among GOP lawmakers protesting the Capitol physician's decision to again require masks in the House chamber.
The vaccines work or they don't work? Do the masks work or they don't work? I'd like to know which it is.
The White House is defending the CDC's move, with spokesman Karine Jean-Pierre saying the agency did its job.
This needed to happen, right? They are following the science.
Top House Republican Kevin McCarthy says it should be based on the science, but it's not.
This is about control.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for being with us. Our thank you to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, Chris Casqueo, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Make sure you stay safe. Enjoy the day ahead.